prosecuted for political activities.
Yes.
Persecuted for political activities.
Yes, I am a member of a political resistance group in Turkey.
And what exactly are you fighting for?
We are fighting for 100% human rights and 100% freedom of speech and 100% social education. In Turkey, just people with money can get education.
Maybe things will get better once you get into the European Union.
I don't trust the European Union.
And why not?
Who is leading the European Union? İşte England, France, and Germany, and Italy, and Spain. These countries are all colonial countries. It's globalization, and we are fighting against that.
Maybe you're a person who just likes to fight.
You think I am crazy? If a country kills the people, the folk, just because they think different, or look different, or because they protest to have work, and energy, and schools, you have to fight back.
Maybe everything will get better once you get into European Union.
Yeah, fuck the European Union, yeah!
I don't want you to talk like that in my house. You can talk like that in your house, okay?
Okay.
That was the upcoming episode in a nutshell. Hello everyone and welcome back. I'm your host Kerim and you are listening to Euronero, the Eurovision Song Contest show on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, broadcasting from the University of British Columbia, which is situated on the traditional, ancestral and stolen territories of the Hunkaminim-speaking Musqueam people. This is the 22nd episode of Euronero, where we are going backwards in recapping the Eurovision Song Contest year by year. And together with me today is a very special guest, Sophie. Say hi.
Ooh, hi.
Sophie hosts Friday Night Fever on CITR 101.9 FM every Friday from 6 to 7:30 p.m. and you should definitely check her amazing show out.
Thank you.
How are you doing?
I'm good. It's the first day of school.
Yes, it's Imagine Day today and Aww. It's very lovely and lively.
Happy Imagine Day.
Do you remember your Imagine Day?
I actually didn't go.
This is the first Imagine Day I'm on campus.
Yeah, because you're like never on campus.
Yeah,
anyway.
I'm never on campus.
I didn't go. I actually like had FOMO, but I was like, I think I like went for lunch with my mm-hmm. mom or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It has been 7 Eurovision years and 9 episodes since you were last here.
Oh my gosh.
It wow. was last December.
Well, it's good to be back.
Yes, yeah. Not last December. Yes, it was last December.
I always love being on the yes. show. What is this? Is this my third or fourth time? Fourth time. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
2016, 2014, 2010, and today's episode.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
at this point, I should mention that we didn't have a new episode in August due to a last-minute renovation scheduled in our live broadcast studio. So sorry about that. But here we are. And in this episode of Euronero, we will be talking about Eurovision 2003. That which took place in Riga, the capital of Latvia, and won by Turkey. Turkey was represented by Sertab Erener and her song Every Way That I Can. As I have promised before, I will take this opportunity to talk about Turkey's aim to position itself within the Western world and its failed attempt to join the European Union, EU. Also, I will hopefully make you hear the winning song from a different perspective along the way. Also wonderful to have Sophie with her point of view as someone who has experienced Eurexit.
Bad times.
So before we start talking about Turkey and its journey to the EU and back, mm-hmm. Let me give some brief details about Eurovision 2003. As I have said before, it was held in Riga, the capital of Latvia, after the country's first and only win in 2002. I should mention here, I think the first decade of the 21st century is very good for Eurovision in the sense that there are a lot of first time winners. Estonia in 2001, Latvia in 2002, Turkey in 2003, Greece in 2005, Ukraine in 2004, Finland in 2006, Serbia in 2007, and Russia in 2008, Norway won before, I'm not going to count that.
Are you saying this all from memory?
Yes, all from memory.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's okay. After the Eurozone economical crisis, that starts to decline. Like, since 2010, there's 2011 Azerbaijan and 2017 Portugal. All the other winners are previous winners. There's no other first-time winners.
I see.
So, I like this era in that sense.
Yeah.
And in the next episode, we'll talk about Latvia's victory. In the other episode, we'll talk about Estonia's victory.
Mm-hmm.
Two former Soviet republics, which I like to hear always. So back to Eurovision 2003. 26 countries participated, which was a record at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The current record is 43 countries in a year.
Mm-hmm.
There were no semifinals, and the points were, quote-unquote, supposedly determined as a result of televotes.
Right.
However, countries had backup juries in case televoting failed because there were no apps in the time.
Mm-hmm.
Although I should say that I think televote did show its effect because I'm looking at the top four.
Mm-hmm.
Turkey, Belgium, Russia and Norway in this order.
Mm-hmm.
And these songs wouldn't have, Turkey might have, but the other songs wouldn't have succeeded as much with a jury vote.
Mm.
For example, the Belgian entry, the one that you also like, Samami.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you know what language is that song?
It's a made-up language.
Yes, it's a made-up language. It's the first time Belgium did that. They did that again in 2008 with a song called O Ulyssy. It was also a very nice song. I think I played it on my show in the episode covering Eurovision 2008.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't have won. That wouldn't have came in second.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a beautiful song.
Mm-hmm.
I love that song. It shows that even though the words have no meaning, this music can tell a lot.
Yeah, that's a nice way to look at it, actually. Yeah.
The BBC commentator said, like, the country has four languages, like Flemish, German, French, and English. They chose to send a song in an imaginary language.
Is it the same imaginary language in both songs, do you think?
I think, can we classify it?
Yeah, that's true. I guess nobody knows. Yeah. There's a way that we could, I'm sure, compare them side by side.
Hopefully, if we have the time, I will play that song as well. But we will see.
Mm.
So, Turkey won the contest for the first and only time in 2003 as a result of a very tight vote with 167 points.
Okay.
Belgium came in second with 165 points, just 2 points less.
Mm-hmm.
And Belgium gave 12 points to Turkey thanks to the diaspora of people from Turkey in Belgium.
Oh.
In Belgium, Germany, Netherlands, there is quite a high amount of Turkish immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a result of a worker deal made between Germany and Turkey in 1960s.
Yeah.
I will talk more about this in our episode covering Eurovision 1999, where Germany was represented with a band of immigrants.
Mm.
So Belgium came in second, and Russia, represented by the famous band Tatu, came in third with their song Never Nebosia, with 164 points, 1 point behind Belgium and 3 points behind the winner, Turkey. Hopefully we will have time to hear Tatu as well. So before we start with the winning song, Turkey's song, let's start talking about the European Union, because today's episode is going to be about that.
Yeah,
I will take very short breaks just to fulfill my required ad time in order to be able to talk as much as possible. So European Union is a political and economical union of 27 member states that are located primarily in Europe.
Mm.
I mean geographically.
Mm-hmm.
The official aim in the forming of the European Union was, and I quote from the EU website, to end the frequent and bloody conflict that culminated in the Second World War. Its foundation is based on the European Coal and Steel Community formed by six countries: Belgium, France, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and the West Germany. And these countries went on to form two more bodies: a European Economic Community, which was formed upon the signing of Treaty of Rome in 1957, mm-hmm. and the European Atomic Energy Community, Euratom, which was formed in the same year. The EEC, European Economic Community, created a common market, removing trade barriers between member states and setting the foundation for deeper economic integration. Throughout the 1960s and 1970s, EEC expanded, admitting new members and broadening its scope. The Maastricht Treaty, signed in 1992, was a significant milestone, transforming the EEC into the European Union. The treaty introduced the concept of European citizenship, established the three-pillar structure of the EU, covering economic, foreign, and judicial policies, and laid the groundwork for the euro, the EU's single currency. Mm-hmm. Is there an EU member that doesn't use euro?
Yes.
Which
well,
one?
There was the UK. Gosh darn it. I think there is. I can't remember, but
no,
I
actually,
think there
Sweden
is.
Doesn't use it. Use it. Sweden
is
has
Sweden
kronor.
A member?
Sweden is a member.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay.
Norway is not a member.
Okay.
Let me double check. Is Sweden EU member? I don't have internet connection.
Okay, well, I'll answer the other question while we wait. Mm-hmm. The seven non-Eurozone members of the EU are Bulgaria, Czech Republic, which is now called Czechia, mm-hmm. Denmark, Hungary, Poland, Romania, and Sweden. So they don't use the euro.
Yes.
Yeah.
Poland, zloty. Sweden, kronor. Bulgaria, mm-hmm. leva.
Okay.
Czechia, koruna. What were the other two countries?
Denmark,
kronor again.
Literally just there, yeah. Romania.
Romania. I don't know Romania.
Man, get this guy in a pub quiz immediately.
yes, I am open for recruitment talks.
Yeah, Romania, so Sweden is an EU member then. Yeah.
Lei. Romania's currency is lei.
Okay.
So Sweden is a member that doesn't use euro. Basically this foundation laid the groundwork for a common shared currency. Mm-hmm. So despite the official goal of the union stating otherwise, I can speculate that the foundation of EU cannot be considered independently of the of something. And I'm going to quote a philosopher that I really like. So this cannot be considered independently of a spectre haunting the Europe.
Mm.
The spectre of communism.
Ah!
This is like the opening sentence of Communist Manifesto.
Oh, really?
Karl Marx,
oh my
yeah.
gosh!
So post-World War, of course. Like the Eurocentric world, that was a Eurocentric world that mm-hmm. lasted more than four centuries, starting from the Renaissance. And it came to an end with the rise of two powers, like the United States and the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So becoming a third power was a common idea among primarily the Western European countries. Because after defeating the Nazis in the World War II, the popularity of the Soviet Union was expanding throughout the Europe. And it wouldn't be, I think, wrong to claim that the main goal of the formation of a union was the search of economic stabilization in the Western Europe and to avoid the appeal of communism. Mm-hmm. The United States also supported this European integration, of course, as part of its broader strategy to contain Soviet expansion. And through initiatives like Marshall Plan, in which $12 billion at that time, it amounts to today's $150 billion, was offered to the European countries. It was offered to Soviet countries as well, but they didn't accept it. And the U.S. provided economic aid to help rebuild Western European economies, further encouraging cooperation among European nations. So, however much it can today be branded as a social democracy or sometimes as a workers' union, EU was based on neoliberal values, like the privatization of the public economic sectors or services, the deregulation of private corporations, the sharp decrease of government budget deficits, and reduction of spending on public works. And it still continues to operate on them, and the member states who attempt to deviate from these foundational principles have historically been punished with harsh austerity measures. If you want to hear in more detail on how the Greece was impacted on such measures, you can check out the episode covering Eurovision 2012. And if you want to know more about how Ireland was forced to accept the Treaty of Lisbon in 2009, you can check out the episode on Eurovision 2008. So, after a brief introduction to EU, I will move on to talk a bit about Turkey's quest to join. But before that, I want to hear your opinions as someone who experienced EU citizenship and...
I've been on either side. Yes. Either side of the coin. So I will say, just for me, myself and I, two things immediately come to mind. One thing is the EU farming subsidies that I think people in the UK, like rural agricultural workers really benefited from. That's not happening anymore. I don't really understand. I haven't been in the UK for a long time, so I don't know what's replaced it after we left the EU.
Can you elaborate a bit more on the farming subsidy?
So basically the EU offers farming subsidies, so they basically enable farmers to farm, even if they have a small farm and not like, you know, a huge, you know, like multinational owned thing, you know, to grow locally and keep the food local. And it basically means that farmers can survive over the winter without having to, you know, like switch up and like produce other things. So yeah, it was a really good thing. And lots of people I know benefited from it. Actually, three things. And I will say the NHS in the UK was also propped up by migrant workers from different EU states. And like, I've heard personally from NHS workers that Brexit has just like been the last nail in the coffin of the NHS, and there's no one to work because we don't have the workforce to support the NHS without the migrant workers. So that's really sad. And then I guess on a personal level, you know, I had always dreamed of living in these different countries and working in, you know, like I used to live in Germany, so I really wanted to go back there. I used to live in Italy. I would have loved to have gone back there. I still can, but it's just a lot more complicated. Mm-hmm. And I liked having the idea of being like, yeah, you know, maybe I can move to this country, and it would be so easy not having to have a visa, and, you know, just being able to have that freedom of movement and being able to, you know, move around. Yeah, so that's my take on it.
Yeah,
I enjoyed being part of the EU.
Especially the freedom of movement, the visa liberalization process was something Turkey dreamt of for a very long time.
Mm.
And around 2016, it seemed literally right around the corner. Like, I remember thinking, okay, I'm going to wake up and we will hear the news that it's visa free now. And because Turkey, as a part of the... integration to the European Union, initially became a customs union member.
Mm-hmm.
So there was always this argument that, okay, our goods are able to roam free, but the producers of those goods are not.
Interesting.
And it's also the European visa process is like nothing I have seen before. Like even Canada wasn't like that for me. Like,
really?
And I applied to US visa in Canada, but that made it a lot more easier, of course. But the European Visa Union process is a very dehumanizing, very discriminatory. Yes.
What was it like, if you don't mind me asking?
This is not a personal experience.
Okay.
Because for the first 25 years of my life, I was under a special passport that allowed me to go to European countries maximum of 90 days without a visa.
Mm-hmm.
And then I applied for a worker's visa, which was much easier to get.
Mm.
But the way I hear, there are heavy reductions in the staff that work on the visa centers.
Okay.
They ask for crazy amount of documentation, necessary or unnecessary. And the rate of rejection increased heavily, especially in the past few years.
Right, okay.
And the reasons of rejection is generally like, we don't trust that you are going to go back, despite however much evidence you provide. And some people, yes, true, they don't plan on going back. But I'm going to try to summarize this throughout the episode, but the situation that is created in Turkey right now, the economic desperation, mainly the driving force of people wanting to migrate, is created by the Turkish government hand in hand with Western powers.
Yeah.
One of the major things that brought us to this point is a milestone in the European and European-Turkey relationships, which I will mention shortly.
Okay.
So, Turkey initially applied to be an associate member of the European Economic Community in 1959, and this was part of the country's foundational paradigm of positioning itself within the Western world. The country took part in the Marshall Plan in 1947, became a member of the Council of Europe in 1950, and became a member of NATO in 1952. In fact, Turkey sent soldiers to the Korean War just because the participating countries were promised NATO membership.
Right.
So, as the modern Turkey, the Republic of Turkey, was founded, it always tried to move away from its Ottoman past. And it sought to define itself as a Western nation state that defined all citizens as Turkish and ignoring all other ethnic identities.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea behind this modern Turkey was to reach the level of contemporary civilization. This I quote from the founder of Turkey, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. And this required a drastic and often forced break from its history, because Ottoman Empire was massive. It included a lot of people from a lot of different ethnicities.
Mm-hmm.
And so this idea led Turkey to position itself as the opposite of East. Like, the whole idea of foundation is to prove that we are not Arabs. We are Turkish. We are a Western state. That's the whole idea on the foundation of Turkey. And I have to say this. Turkey was founded on genocides, both during the end period of Ottoman Empire, which showed the genocides of Armenian people and the Greek people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, the term genocide is made to define the actions of the Ottoman Empire towards the Armenian people.
Yeah.
And this continued during the foundation of the Republic too. Like, all other cultures except for the Turkish culture, Turkish language, Turkish identity was suppressed, tried to be omitted through heavy displacements, heavy murders, heavy ethnic cleansings. So we have a country that is that defines itself on a single national identity and tries to distance itself from the Eastern, identities. But this didn't fit well, of course, because the region Turkey is found on is called Anatolia, is a super diverse and transitional region.
Yeah.
So the assumption that a assimilationist model would work was really flawed. As Turkey tried to forge a Western identity, breaking away from the East became an obsession, and it deepened its cultural clashes within the country. The more evident it became, the more rigidly it was enforced. That was the worst part. So, in the end, I will say again, what characterized modern Turkey was a fierce insistence on not being Eastern in any way. And this paranoia especially came into effect during one of the biggest milestones that defined the characteristic of the Turkey-EU relationships, the refugee protection crisis. I will delve more into it soon. I should take a very short break, but we will come back to talk about Turkey's quest to join the EU.
A healthy lifestyle during midterms, finals, or any time throughout the year? Then Freshii has you covered. Stop in today at Freshy on Westbrook Mall and order one burrito, salad, or bowl and get the second for free. Buy one, get one for free. Freshy on Westbrook Mall is your one-stop food as fuel choice for people on the move. Freshy, eat, energize. The 36th Annual Vancouver Queer Film Festival takes place this September 11th until the 22nd, in theaters and online BC-wide. Celebrate 2S LGBTQIA+ stories, enjoy vibrant parties and performances, and connect with queer community this September at Vancouver Queer Film Festival. Make sure to get your tickets for Centerpiece Presentation, happening on September the 18th at the Vancouver Playhouse. Discover new stories for us, by us, and get your tickets now at queerfilmfestival.ca.
Welcome back, everyone. You are on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, and you are listening to Euronero, the Eurovision Song Contest show of CITR. In this episode, I am joined by Sophie from the CITR show Friday Night Fever.
Hello.
And we are talking about Eurovision 2003, and in the context of Eurovision 2003, Turkey's bid to join the European Union. So, before we took the break, I mentioned the motive behind Turkey's application to join the EU. And as I said, this was part of an identification aim, that a country newly formed trying to be identified as part of the Western world. So I'll briefly talk about the timeline of Turkey's accession to the EU. As I said before, Turkey applied to become an associate member of the European Economic Community in 1959. In 1963, an agreement was signed. Its official name is Agreement Creating an Association Between the Republic of Turkey and the European Economic Community, also known as Ankara Agreement. This was signed to integrate Turkey into a customs union with the EEC, with acknowledging the final goal of membership. So, I will reiterate a number of times, but during several steps of this timeline, Turkey was promised membership. Like, they will say it was said that no matter what happens, the end of this negotiation, these negotiations, is membership. Although EU is not very is very reluctant to meet this promise, because Turkey is a massive country. Mm-hmm. It's like, I forgot the population of Germany. I think it was around 85-86 million. Turkey is either a bit larger than Germany or second largest throughout Europe, if you include Turkey as well. So that would change things a lot. Turkey would have an enormous number of seats in the European Parliament due to its population, mm-hmm. and that would change things a lot. I just wanted to say, even though, like, at a number of points the membership was mentioned, today the process is frozen, and I see no hope in it becoming finalized.
What do you want?
I want dissolution of EU.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
I want formation of a more fair union that basically does more or less the same thing,
mm-hmm.
Freedom of movement, for example, things
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
But in a better way that protects the rights of workers.
Interesting.
Because, like, I think EU is a massive burden on the working class people. Like, for example, it has a common farming policy, right?
Yeah.
Not every country produces all the goods by themselves.
Yeah.
It's, like, partitioned.
Yeah.
So, let's say EU decides to take in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
The olive producer in Greece would have to feed a country 80 million more people with their olive.
I see, okay.
So, Turkey is also has Mediterranean climate, so, like, olive is just an example. But this is a massive burden on the working class people. So, EU by itself doesn't meet these expectations. Like, it has so much more things to be improved.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea. I don't like the implementation. That's why joining the EU right now for Turkey. Actually, I haven't thought about that in a very long time. Like, yeah.
Wait, so what if, okay, but why dissolve and then make a new union that's really similar? Why not just change the union that you're currently in?
The change is too,
you know, too big.
Too big, yeah. Yeah, too big.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yes, that was my hot take. yes. so, in 1987, Turkey submitted its application for formal membership. The initial application was for an associate membership into the European Economic Community. However, this application was deferred in 1982, quote-unquote, more favorable times. They cited Turkey's economic and political situation, as well as its poor relations with Greece. The relationships with Greece were always has always been tense, but it rapidly deteriorated after Turkey's invasion of the northern Cyprus in 1974. I will talk more about it in the episode covering Eurovision 1975. In 1975, I'll just give a sneak peek. Greece's entry to the contest was called Panajamu Panajamu. It's like something like My Mary, referring to Mother Mary. Which was directed specifically against the Turkish invasion of Cyprus. Turkey televised the final, but censored the Greek entrance performance. Instead of that, they played a nationalist Turkish song titled Memleketim, My Motherland, which was one of the symbols of the Turkish invasion of Cyprus in Turkey. So that was also cited to defer the application. But the accession talks started in 1997, after the formation of the EU. When the Luxembourg Council declared Turkey to be eligible to become an EU member. The period between 1997 and 1999 is a bit stormy. But because there is a postmodern military coup in the meanwhile in Turkey, in which the military threatened the coup, but by doing that, forcing the government to resign and do an early election. But in 1998, if I remember correctly, Turkey gave like an ultimatum that we need progression in this. And in 1999, European Council's Helsinki summit declared Turkey officially as a candidate country, and the talks of membership have started with its ups and downs and freeze and tolls. So from 1999, after the candidacy became official, this also caused some schisms in Turkey as well. Until 2002, Turkey was mainly run by coalition governments. And there were parties that were pro-EU and there were countries that were anti-EU. For example, far-right parties generally opposed the EU because EU application or EU acceptance, the membership acceptance required a lot of reforms on the ethnic groups' rights, mm-hmm. including right to get educated in their own language, right to broadcast in their own language, and far-right parties were opposing it by then. Now that far-right party is in the government coalition currently. Another thing about that, another part of application, another criteria that needed to be met was abolishment of the death penalty. Death penalty remained effectively in place until 1984. That was the last time it was executed. It was officially lifted, like removed from the constitution in 2004. So when people talk about the Turkey's accession process, they generally divide it into pre and post Helsinki, the Helsinki summit in 1999. I prefer to think of it as pre and post Erdogan's rule. Erdogan is the current president, and he started his rule as a prime minister in... when did he become prime minister? I forgot when he became. Like, his party came to rule in 2002. Mm-hmm. Because of having been convicted, he wasn't able to be elected as an MP then. So it took him a while to become the prime minister. I forgot that. But his party coming into power was a turning point in the Turkey's bid to join the EU. Of course, there was some acceleration around end 2001 and beginning of 2002. And Erdogan's party came into power in November 2002, like 6 months before the Eurovision 2003. But in 2001, there were some constitutional amendments to made to meet the criteria. In August 2002, there was a European Harmonization Package that was passed to abolish the death penalty and recognize the education and broadcasting in minority languages. And Erdogan's party, Justice and Development Party, I'll call it AKP as it's abbreviated in Turkish, came to power almost simultaneously with 2002 Copenhagen Summit, where Turkey declared its willingness, is the right word, to meet the Copenhagen criteria, that are things that a country has to meet to be able to be a member of the EU. These consist of stable political institutions and the guarantee of human rights and the rule of law, economic stability and the existence of a robust market that could cope with economic integration within the EU, and acceptance of the common acquis. So Erdogan came into power among this accelerated process, and he was pragmatist. He has always been a pragmatist, and he initially started building upon these. One of the main reasons Erdogan started as a pro-European Union government was that he started his political life in an Islamist party. He was not the leader, and in those parties, the leader is the main person. So he was not the leader, but he started as the mayor of Istanbul, which is like the first step in Turkey to becoming to having the power. He separated himself from that party after they were forced out of the government by a threat of a military coup. And in order to obtain the power and maintain it, he tried to show that he was going to lead a different path. Because, as I said, Turkey was constantly run by coalition governments, and the conflicts between the parties of coalitions caused a lot of instability, economical crisis, and military coups in Turkey. From 1960 until now, there have been either a military coup or a coup attempt in every decade. So Erdogan wanted to depend on the EU because he considered it as a safeguard for his government against a military coup. And they another thing was that they said they were assuming a conservative democracy agenda, which is kind of similar to the Christian democrats in the Europe. This consisted of execution of liberal democratic reforms, improvements on the Cyprus issue, abolishment of death penalty, and removal of restrictions to education and broadcasting in minority languages. This death penalty, I will very briefly touch on it, was a massive issue because by the time this came into the question in 1999, the leader of the Kurdish organization PKK, in Kurdish Kurdistan Workers Party, was arrested, and he was subjected to death penalty. And the abolishment of death penalty comes into a similar time between around the time he was arrested. And this was met with heavy criticism from the far right party because they wanted him to be executed. He's still under heavy isolation, like in an inhumane condition. So I just briefly wanted to touch on it. As I said, Erdogan's term started with a Europe-directed policies. And I want to listen or hear the Turkish Eurovision 2003 entry as a part of this. Mm-hmm. It's called Every Way That I Can. Let's first hear the song. Mm-hmm. And I will try to talk about how the lyrics match with the Turkey's bid to join the EU. Have you listened to the song?
I haven't.
I'm very curious about what you are going to do. So now we will hear Every Way That I Can by Sertab Erener representing Turkey in Eurovision 2003.
Knock, knock. Guess who? MRG Live coming right back at you, this time with a whole new list of upcoming live shows by your favorite artists. Hear this. Marika Hackman, Faye Webster, Empress of, Peter Cat Recording Co., and The Rare Occasions are a few of the artists MRG Live is bringing to you. Follow at MRG Live Official on Instagram to stay tuned with all the artists performing near you.
Two Tune into Post Rock Friday from 10 to 11 with your host John P for the best in post rock, drone, ambient, experimental, and noise.
Welcome back, everyone. You are on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, and you are listening to Euroneuro, the Eurovision Song Contest show of CITR. We've just heard before the break the winning song of Eurovision 2003, Every Way That I Can, by Serta Perner, representing Turkey. What did you think, Sophie?
So I actually had heard it. I made a mistake. Okay. I have heard it. I also, we watched the live performance and just love the costumes, love the R&B vibes. Love the like belly dancing kind of thing they got going on. I thought it was great.
It was amazing, yeah. Wasn't it? Yeah. How would you place it among the other songs of that year?
I think it's definitely up there because some of the other songs were terrible.
Like which one?
Like, oh, okay. I don't want to name names.
No,
but like,
go ahead. Name.
Like
that's
the
what
UK's
we do in this
one.
Show. Yes.
Yeah, and it came last, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's the first time UK got 0 points.
Yes.
There is a motive behind it. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for reminding me that. Mm-hmm. The reason that Turkey won, Turkey got high televote, is the same as UK got 0 votes.
Ah.
Because March 2003, is when US started its invasion of Iraq.
Right.
And
yes,
UK supported that. And a lot of people connect the 0 points to UK's support of the invasion of Iraq.
Ah, okay.
There was Turkish government, Erdogan's government also wanted to support that. They wanted to let US use the military bases and airspace of Turkey to attack Iraq. But there was a massive public protest opposing it. On March 1st, there was a vote on the parliament to allow this or not. And it was a massive campaign, massive anti-war campaign. And very surprisingly, it was rejected on the parliamentary vote. It was surprising because it was a two-party assembly then, because when Erdogan won the elections, it won with such a high vote. And only two parties passed the electoral threshold of 10%. So there were only two parties in the assembly, and majority of them were Erdogan's MPs. And despite that, the public protest managed to prevent that bill from passing. And Turkey's win, popularity in the televote, is also connected to this, like Turkey not supporting, at least in public level, the invasion of Iraq.
Interesting. Okay, I didn't know that. Yes. It makes a lot of sense.
So speaking of the song, I will tell how I connect this to the European bid of Turkey.
A bit at the end
so
as well.
The name, Every Way That I Can, and the lyrics, Every Way That I Can, I'll Try To Make You Love Me Again. This is a cry for Europe, to Europe, saying that I will make you love me again. Like, I have a new government now, new policies, and I will make you love me again. So, and another thing, where was that? Oh, I'm in love with you, I'll do all you want me to. That's, I think, clear reference to the Copenhagen criteria that the Turkey promised to meet. And secondly, thirdly, sorry, nothing in the world that could stop me is a clear reference to the geopolitical situation, conjuncture of the world at that time. Yes,
I think you could write an essay about this. I'm not joking.
Yes.
Seriously. No, like
actually, yeah.
Yeah,
that's true. So yeah, that's what I think. So that's how the Erdogan's government or the Erdogan's rule, let me say, started. And so there are a lot of things that affected the Turkey-EU relations. I have only 10 minutes left. 1 hour is not enough for me for this show. there are a lot of things in the 1970s, 80s, 1990s, especially military coup. So I will not talk about this now. I will talk about those things in our episode covering upcoming episodes covering those years. But right now I want to give a brief summary of the milestones of European-Turkey relationships during Erdogan's rule, 2002 onwards. So one of the biggest ones is again like military coup, of course. In 2007 there was an electronic coup where the army published a statement in their official website, again threatening the government of a coup, but very subtly, that led to a early election, which Erdogan really, really, really solidified his power. Like, it almost reached 50% of the vote. It's massive. There was only one region that they didn't get an MP from. Out of 81, they got from 80. That was one. And, like all the military coups, all the attempts, it heavily turns the country in on itself, heavily delays the progression of relations. Another milestone was in 2013, where there was massive countrywide protests in Turkey, originated from Istanbul, a park in Istanbul. It's called Gezi Park. Erdogan wanted to build a museum, like a Ottoman army museum there, by cutting down trees. And there were people camping in the park in order not to prevent the trees from being cut down. They were dispersed very violently overnight, and this caused like, I think on June 20th in 2013, Angela Merkel immediately suspended the accession talks with Turkey after that police brutality. That was one of the milestones. 2016 coup attempt was another big milestone. I don't know if you remember that.
No.
The military coup attempt in Turkey. Like, when Erdogan was coming to power, he did it not just with his party. He also used the religious group as an ally.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I remember you said. Yeah.
They attempted a coup, and that didn't happen. But a civil coup followed by Erdogan, like massive shutdown of civil organizations, newspapers, TV channels, a lot of firings of public employees. Like, there were lists of people being published with their identification numbers, like thousands of people every morning, and you would go to them to see if anyone you know is in there.
Oh my gosh.
Because, like, they're going to be prosecuted, and it's civil death. Like, you cannot get any jobs, you cannot do anything if you are if your name is on there. And another massive part of that was arrest of Kurdish MPs.
Yeah.
The Kurdish political party, Kurdish political movement, entered the assembly as a party for the first time in 2015 elections, and it was the biggest opposition group against Erdogan, not by number, but by the opposition that they do. Its leaders were arrested overnight, along with other MPs, and they are still in the in jail.
Whoa.
It has been 7
oh my
years.
God.
8 years, I apologize. Like, this is another one of the things. Like, European Court of Human Rights ruled in favor of those leaders twice, in 2018 and 2020. Turkey didn't accept it. Despite there's an actual law in constitution saying that if ECHR rules against the Turkish law, ECHR has to be followed. It is always about the Turkish law. This is another thing that damaged the European-Turkish relationships, but the relationship still survives for one thing, the refugee protection crisis. Let me briefly summarize that. So initially, so, as I said in the beginning of the episode, what characterized modern Turkey was a fierce insistence of not being Eastern. And the dominance of this anti-Eastern identity, especially among the secular middle class, is evident and very heavily triggered during the refugee protection crisis in early 2010s, when a massive influx of Syrian refugees started to come to Turkey after the civil war against the dictator of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, started. It was followed by refugees from Iraq after the emergence and rising of ISIS. And initially, Turkey was a transit country, so mainly refugees were crossing the border to escape the civil war in their country, but as many were moving on to settle in Europe, either through land borders or through the very dangerous agency route. I have talked about this in detail in the episode covering Eurovision 2018, so I won't go into that. But in December 2013, Turkey and EU signed a readmission agreement. I'll just go to my notes on that. Turkey signed a readmission agreement with the EU, which required Turkey to take back migrants who had entered the EU, quote unquote, illegally. I will never call a human being illegal on this show or anywhere else. In return, the EU agreed to open negotiations of visa-free travel for Turkish citizens within the Schengen area. The agreement was part of a border deal reached in 2016 where Turkey agreed to take back refugees who had entered Greece in exchange of financial aid. European Union promised and gave 6 billion euros to Turkey to keep the refugees. So this was a very dirty bargain over the lives of the refugees, and many refugees in Turkey face discrimination, exploitation and abuse, because as I have covered in the previous episodes, in Turkey only Western asylum seekers are granted the status of refugees. I'm not going to be able to play any other songs. That's okay. Listen to Belgium's entry, Russia's entry, Iceland's entry. That was Sophie's choice. Sophie's choice.
I was like, didn't even say it.
And Norwegian entry too. Anyways, so the deal has also strained Turkey's relationship with the EU, with both sides accusing each other of failing to live up to their commitments. So after, this was both the thing that kept EU and Turkey bonded together, but also heavily damaged the relationships. And this is also one of the reasons EU doesn't is not willing to admit Turkey anymore, because there's a heavy amount of refugees here in Turkey, and although Europe will not openly admit it, it is founded on a European superiority ideology, and it does this by promoting inequality, corruption in other countries, and that's how it establishes a sense of superiority, in my opinion. So this affected the relationships as well, and in 2020, just before COVID, Turkey's forces in Syria, the Turkish occupation forces in Syria, because Turkey occupied a lot of spaces in Syria, was attacked. And Turkey was very disappointed for it, and it literally allowed and forced Syrian refugees to cross the border to the Europe. If it weren't for COVID, that situation would be terrible for the refugees who were forced to go to a very dangerous route. Mm-hmm. I wish I had time to speak more on that. So another thing was the unitary presidential referendum in 2017, which solidified Erdogan's power. From a parliamentary democracy, Turkey moved on to a unitary presidential governance, in which all three, judiciary, executive and legislation, was given to one person, which turned out to be Erdogan. So this heavily affected the Turkey-European Union relationships as well. And currently, the accession bid is on a freeze. And I don't see it being solved or being improved unless there are major drastic changes, which I don't see nearby. I have so much more to talk about, but I have to close here. I hope I managed to convey my message of what I think about the European Union. Mm-hmm. Any closing remarks, Sophie?
Oh, I just want to say thanks so much. I feel like I've just listened to a podcast on 2x the speed, you know? I've learned so much.
Thank you. Thank you. That was my goal. Yes. I wish I had more time. But thank you all for tuning in. I hope to meet with you in my upcoming episode covering Eurovision 2002, which won't be in October because I have a very important exam coming up. Mm. I will be preparing for that. Hopefully, by the end of October, or either the last week of October or the first week of November, I hope to be with you again with our episode covering Eurovision 2002. And thank you so much for coming in, Sophie.
Of course. Thanks for
having me. It was great to have you here, as always.
Yes.
Until next time, take care and goodbye.